Welcome, everyone, to a special bonus episode of Underserved. I've known Ben Hodson for over 20 years, and when he came in to record, we went over most of those years and back a few more. The first part of our conversation is in our regular episode entitled Ancient History. This bonus episode is called Modern History and picks up when Ben and I met one another at Monster.com. Let's continue the conversation.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
So once again, who you know in your network helps out a lot, as your friend and colleague Brian Pierce helps get you into Monster.
So Brian had ended up at Monster, and he, you know, I was reaching out going like, yeah, this is not working out here. He's like, you got to come down here, dude. This place is awesome. We have this thing called the Den, and there's free snacks, and there's food, and there's sodas. And I was like, oh God, another dot bomb, like essential, like what's going to happen here? So I went down to Monster and checked it out. Again, it was going to be a big commute. Like the nice thing about that, the other place was it was in New Hampshire where I was living, so it was an easy commute. Now, got to go down to Maynard. And I was like, all right, I'll come down and check it out. So I drove down. And what was really funny was Monster is in the old deck clock tower place, which is this huge old mill building, right? And I have no idea where to go. Brian had said, oh, we're in this building 4 or something like that. And I was like, okay. So I just kind of go in there and looking around and I'm like, all right. And like I followed somebody through the secure door. Not even thinking about it, just walked in behind somebody, went up to the floor I thought he was on, and I'm literally just walking around the cube farm. I finally like ran into, as you will know her, Luba, and I'm like, hey, can you tell me who would I talk to about an interview for the data? And she's like, why are you over here? Like the front desk is like 2 buildings away, like way over there. I'm like, oh. And she's like, what are you interviewing for? And I'm like, oh, for data. And she's like, oh, I'm on that team. Hold on. Let me get you to Don, who is the hiring manager. And she just walked me around. So I like completely skipped the front desk and just ended up like talking to the guy and interviewing there and talking with Brian. And they gave me the whole tour and everything. And I bit and was like, all right, this seems pretty cool. And they had no database engineers at the time. The developers, who I will not name, were running rampant at the time.
We had that sweet production access.
Yeah. When I got there, they were really moving from startup to enterprise, right? And everything was about how do we shore everything up? I don't think they'd gone public at that point, or they had just gone public at that point. So they had a lot of money and they were just trying to get everything put together in a way that it would actually be sustainable moving ahead. I got brought in to like standardize the database layer. Brian came in to standardize the databases and make sure they performed well. And we instigated process. And that was where it all started. And that was an amazing ride working there. I think we redesigned process, 4 times in the time that we were there? Rinse and repeat, right? Make it a little better every time we did it.
So while I was a little pissed that I lost my production access.
Yes.
I was very happy when you came up with code generators in order to standardize the processes.
Yeah. So as being the only database engineer with a fleet of developers pounding on your door now to get stuff out into the database, it was self-preservation that I had to come up with ways to programmatically do these things. So today, there's various ways that you can auto-create a stored procedure for a table, right? For a select, for an insert, for an update. There wasn't then. So I went back to my old VB skills and using Visual Basic wrote what we called the proc-o-matic. And proc-o-matic, you connected to the database, you pointed at a table, you pushed a button, and it spit out all the procs for you in script, checked them into your source control, deployed them with whatever release it was.
Now, that's a big one too, because back then, and even today, you see it once in a while, like, the database is often not treated as a first-class citizen when it comes to version control and just rigorous management of the schema, what's going into it, what's coming out of it. We do a new release. Is there a new column? Is it nullable? Does that blow stuff up? Like, you know, just all that stuff. And this handled it well.
Yeah. Well, we piggybacked on top of the proc-o-matic deploy-o-matic. You may see a schema to my naming of my applications. And Deploy-O-Matic did exactly that. It tied into that source control so that when a release went out, it was actually just releasing the source code that was tagged to that release, right? And what that prevented was a lot of the tools at the time and still today were doing DB compares. And people were comparing their dev or their QA to their production and letting this tool just merge like what you had in QA into production, and that was how you did your release. Somebody accidentally had a bug in QA that nobody had noticed. Hey, that was in production now, right? So it wasn't that you definitively selected this code to go to production. It was some program deciding that it was going to merge some stuff, and whatever happened to be there is what ended up in production. Brian, in particular, hated that, which if you've worked with a lot of DBAs, that's very common. So we wrote this tool that you had to pick the actual objects you were going to deploy, and really that opened up other things. Well, how do I deploy things in the right order? Like, because I can't deploy a stored procedure that uses a table if the table isn't there yet. And worse, foreign keys, how do I deploy a foreign key if the table that it's foreign keying to isn't there yet? It was a fun project, actually, to write that thing, because you had to figure out the order of precedence for all the objects. You then put them in different folders. You stored them that way in your source control. And then when you release them, you just said, okay, release all the tables first, then release, you know, the procs after that, then release all your indexes. And it would go through and it would do everything in the right order. Once you'd done that once, all you had to worry about was putting your objects in the source control, tagging them for that given release, and you were done.
Would it know to do like an alter table on an existing table?
Or? Yep. So there's two different ways we handle that, because we still use the same process today at Sonos. Is if you have an alter, you either are going to alter it in a separate script, and we had another folder within our source control that was just aux, and aux would be under the database that it's related to. And within aux, there were data scripts and there were alter scripts. And the alter scripts would always run right after the tables, just in case you were actually altering a table that you were also building, which would be bad practice, but that's still the order. And it would then just add that column. The data scripts would run post everything else to make sure all the tables were there. And that way you could do, if you had reference tables, if you had lookup tables, you could have your data script to actually load that lookup table in your same release, in your same source control, and it would run at the end. The other methodology is you take that same alter script and you actually put it on the table script. I like this one better now. I kind of prefer this methodology. So you have your table script and you go in and you modify it and you add your column to the create. And you also add a section that says, like, if this column does not exist in this table, then add this column. So if you, for some reason, had a fresh environment, it would run just the table create and it would be done, and you'd get all the tables, all the columns you expected. Or you would run just the little alter piece if the table was already there. The other thing that we had to do with all of these scripts is they had to be non-destructive. So you had to be able to run these over and over and over and over without messing any of it up.
Reentrant.
Excellent word. We had to say, like, if table exists, don't create it again. Like, I don't want to drop and recreate the table. If that somehow got into production, that would be bad, right? So always, if it's there, leave it. If it's there and it's missing this column, just add this column. Stored procedure is not so bad. I can drop a stored procedure and recreate it fast enough. It wouldn't matter. Indexes, again, have to be a little careful there. But you always, even your data scripts, you want to check to make sure the data hasn't already been inserted or updated that you're about to do. And once you've done that, now I have a thing that I'm deploying that I can deploy repeatedly in dev. Bang, 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 bang. And it's not going to cause any problems. It's going to be able to be done. I have that same package. I hand it to QA. They release it to the QA environment. Now it's that same package that now gets released to production. I've proven exactly what I'm pushing through the system as I go through, rather than letting something infer what's going to happen. So I recently had this argument again at work of like, well, why is everything in source control? And we went through the same process. And as we're replatforming now and we're moving to Git from Perforce, we're going through the same process. And I'm like, well, I've used the same folder structure for like 20 years now. I think we can just move this to Git and keep moving with it.
After you get things kind of standardized, you end up becoming a dev lead as your next role?
So again, Monster was an amazing place to work, and people were pushed to do things. So I started out as their first database engineer. I went from there to heading up a team of like three. Then we had like three teams. We went global. We had a development center in Prague. We had a development center in Malaysia. And I was kind of running all these teams. Mark Conway, our boss at the time, came to me and said, all right, dude, you're going to be our new global database architect. And I was like, what? I'm like, no, I'm just like the little database engineer who sits here and does. And he's like, yeah, that's what you call yourself. But you're really the database architect. You think this is a stretch? It's not. Come on, we're starting a whole architecture group over in the other building. And I moved off and I started doing that. I did that for a couple of years. And even in that role, every database change came across my desk. We would review everything, all the different teams, we would get together, we would share, and we all learned a ton from each other as we went through that process. But I kind of stagnated. It was really, really interesting to go from in the weeds to looking at things from a higher level and thinking about things from a systems level rather than just a like, okay, what table, what column, but like, what are we going to do with it? How does it interact with other things? And that was an amazing opportunity that I got there. I wanted to move overseas. We had a development center in Prague. I looked to move over there, and there was an opportunity because they had tried to split the code base. Europe wanted to go its own way. They didn't want to wait for slow US to get their act together to do the stuff that they wanted in the application in EU. How are they going to do that? They also tried to split the database, which I was adamantly against because I was like, dude, this is not going to work. Like, if I have a login in one and I don't have a login to the other, what if I have a resume in France and I want to apply to a job in the US? How do I do that? And they were like, all right, we'll leave the database together. And I'm like, okay, good. But there was a head over in the EU that really wanted to split the databases still. And he was like even saying like, we're going to go to Oracle instead of SQL Server just to make it that much more difficult for us to put this stuff back together. So there was an opening for head of development in the recruiter side. And one of the people who was the head over there was a good friend. And he was like, yeah, please come over and help us with this. Like, we could really use your help. And I was like, okay. And so I packed up the family and we moved over to Prague. And I took on this new role heading up the recruiter team, which was all development. And I'd been to Prague once before for some training, some database training for our database team over there. And it was a beautiful city. Still love it. Still has a special place in my heart. We got there and we ran around for the whole first day just trying to find an apartment. Like, we didn't have an apartment. We had an apartment company and they took myself and my wife at the time and our kids and they ran us from this and showed us all these different places. So by the end of the day, we had ourselves an apartment for at least the next 2 months while we looked for another apartment that was going to be our more permanent one, walked into the office the next day. Prague is a really easily walkable city, great trams, great, you know, underground. For me, I didn't own a car for the first time in my life since I was able to drive. I had no vehicle. As I'm walking into the office, I look over and I see the guy, you know, who's running the sanitation truck, picking up the trash, and he's drinking a beer in one hand while he's dumping the trash into that. I'm like, drinking out in public? Okay. All right. That's good. I come around a corner and this woman propositions me and I'm like, no, thanks. I'm on my way to work. I'm like, what is going on here? And I walk by this car and there's a guy sitting in the front seat and he's got like this spoon and a lighter. And I'm just like, where have I moved to? Like,
apparently the red light district of Prague.
Okay. So I get into the office and I walk upstairs and I go to the head of the office there, Rich Bonazzoli at the time. And I say, Rich, what? Like, where have I moved to? Like, what's the deal here? Like, drinking in public? He's like, legal. I'm like, prostitution? He's like, legal. I'm like, drug use? He's like, well, legal to use, not legal to sell. And I'm like, well, how does that work? Like, buy this pencil, get this free bag of stuff? He's like, I don't know, but those are the way the laws are laid out. And I'm like, all right. So I go and I sit with my team and I have, I think it was 14 different people from 13 different countries who are on my team now, right? So like one of the really cool things about Prague is it's a hub for people from all over to come and work in tech. So I was like, oh my gosh, like this is insane. Everybody spoke English in the office, but they were from everywhere in the world. And I was convinced they hated me for like the first week I worked there because I would walk over to their desk and I'd be like, hey, how's it going? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And they'd be like, I'm working on this thing right now. Can we talk later? Like everybody I would talk to was like that. Jeez. All right. And then lunch would come and they'd swing by and they'd pick me up and we'd go out for lunch. And then we'd go back to the office and like everybody left the office for lunch. There was nothing there. There was no calf. I don't even know if we had fridges, honestly. And they used to give out these little things that were called stravenki that you got with your pay every month. And they were basically food stamps, good at restaurants and at any place that you could buy food. Not for alcohol, only for food. And everybody would use those to go out to lunch. So you would go out and you'd use one or two. And usually they would last you the month for what you would want to give. Got to the point where I would have extras and I ended up giving them to the homeless because I was like, ha, you can only buy food with this, right? And, you know, that's great. And that whole pattern, though, like all of a sudden at 5, everybody's like, all right, come on, we're going out for drinks. Let's go. And I was like, it slowly dawned on me, okay, they don't hate me. They work different, right?
When they're working, they're working.
When you're working, you're working. And then let's go have some fun. right? And it was very different than working here in the US, where everybody works, but you go get a coffee and you might end up in a 20-minute conversation in the cafe while you're getting your coffee. And people think that these are like good things, right? Because you make those connections and you may have a conversation that you may have missed if you didn't do that. But what I've learned is it's super inefficient. It's constant interruption to what you're doing. It's constant context switching when you do those things, right? If you can't tell by now, I work from home and avoid all that context switching other than when the dog like comes and has to go out or something like that. But that methodology of work, what I found was super, super efficient. Like if when you got to work, you sat down and you just focused on work until lunch, and then you took a break for a half hour and you went and hung out with people and did all your kibitzing and talking. And then you went back to it and you worked again. And then when you were done with work, you actually went out with people and you had another relationship, a friend relationship with these people. And so much of this is like now everybody commutes so far. Like when I was commuting to Boston, like I didn't want to hang around after work. Like, are you kidding me? Like, yeah, it might save me some time on my commute, but like, I got to get home and to the family and whatever. I had a family in Prague, but it was 10 minutes from the office home. So if I went out and had a drink and it was an extra half hour, that had like zero bearing on how long it took to get home. So I adopted this whole new thing and I didn't realize that I had been sucked into it. Came back to Maynard, to the mothership of Monster, and it's been maybe a year. And I sat down and I was starting to do some work and somebody swings by, hey, Ben, great to see you back. How's it going over there? What's it like? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, can we talk at lunch? Right? And like, I found it so intrusive to have people coming by and talking to me when I was trying to do work about stuff other than work. And I was like, oh, crap, I'm a convert. Like, I didn't even realize that just happened. And it still took me probably 2 years from when I moved back to fully feel comfortable back in that mode of like, oh, interruptions are fine. Everything's great. Don't worry about it.
It's hard to get used to again.
It is.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So there's a new CTO when you get back, right?
Yeah. So as we worked through that process, I was there and I was in that role for about 3 or 4 months, and pretty much all of the upper management shifted out from under. And all of a sudden it was like, wait, I don't think they're so hot on changing anything anymore. I think they found the problems with being split. It means you're actually doing twice as much work in two separate code bases and you have to keep them aligned. And it's really hard, pretty much aligned with the people I still knew in the US. And we agreed to put the code back together within about a month. Pretty much took me out of a job. Because now all of a sudden the team that I was leading there actually reported to a leader back in Maynard. And I was like, okay, cool. And they said, hey, this is great. What do you want to do next? And I was like, well, since I've been at Monster, like the thing that I've seen suffer the most and really require the most need had been the data warehouse. And it's always the place that cut first. It was always the place that really didn't get enough attention. So I said to my boss at the time, look, I'll take over the data warehouse. I'd really love that opportunity, but you got to guarantee me you're not going to cut my budget like for the next couple years. And he's like, I'm like, no. Like you can cut anywhere else, but you can't cut my budget. Like we don't have a huge budget to begin with. Just don't cut my budget. And he's like, all right, fine. 2 years. Took that role and really learned a ton about data warehousing. More so how not to do data warehousing. But I learned a lot about it. I learned a lot about what we did. We really spent a lot of time trying to make it more performant and more easy to manage. It was a great experience. Learned a ton more about database work that the patterns for doing warehousing versus the patterns for doing transactional systems are very different. So really started to learn all of that. And it was a really good place and things went really well. And to be honest, my boss totally did not cut my team until I was the one who was cut from it. So after about 2 years, probably a little less than that of doing that, someone in the head office back in Maynard finally realized, hey, we're paying this guy in Prague a U.S. salary, like a good U.S. salary. Like, why are we doing that? And this is his monster is kind of turning on the downside. LinkedIn had really started to eat our lunch. And I was like, uh-oh. And they, sure enough, they said, I'm sorry, we're going to let you go. Here is like 9 months severance, though, right? I'd been there, I think, 9 years, and they were paying out at like 1 month per year you'd been there. And I was like, Jesus, all right, and they agreed to move me back to the US when I, you know, by the end of the year. And I was like, okay. So now I'm in Prague. I am a Czech millionaire, right? From the amount of krona they give you. I think the rate had been like 20 to 1 or something like that, right? So I'm like, oh my gosh, okay. I recently separated from my wife. She's back in the US with the kids. I'm in Prague by myself with a pocket full of money. You know, I couldn't think of why to move back right away. It's much lower cost of living. I have an established place. I can do my interviews from where I am. And I stay there for 3 months, right? While I try to figure all this stuff out. That was kind of fun, right? Like I was kind of just goofing around then. The people in the office hated me during that time because I would be camped out in front of the office, like at the end of every day, looking for people to go out and have a drink with. And they were always like, dude, like we were just out with you last night. I need to recover, right? And it was just crazy. But at the same time, I was shopping around trying to find a job, looked at a couple of consulting gigs in Australia and various places, and realized I really had to come back to the US. I really wanted to be closer to my kids. That was really the driving factor. And so I talked to Brian again, right? Brian had gone back to that financial company. He'd left Monster. He was back at the financial company in downtown Boston. And he said, oh, you're looking? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, okay, no problem. I'll set you up with an interview. And I'm like, what? He's like, we could definitely use you, like totally. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like set me up an interview. And I remember doing the pre-screen in Egypt from this hotel room on my laptop. And on my way out of Prague, there were things that I'd promised myself when I moved to Europe. Like I have to go to Egypt. I have to see the pyramids. So on my way out, like I've shipped all my stuff. All my possessions are in my suitcases right now.
Time to do the bucket list.
So I went to Barcelona. I did like 3 or 4 days in Barcelona where I like wore the leather off my shoes walking around that city and just taking crazy photographs. Went back, moved back, basically a complete reset on my life. Like literally moved back into my parents' basement, like when I came back because I had nowhere to go, nothing to do. Interviewed with Brian's company, got a job there, got an apartment. Like right down in Medford and took the T every day. I was kind of in that mindset. I kind of liked not having a car for 3 years. Like it was kind of freeing to just walk everywhere. And besides, I'd lost like 30 pounds. I was in great shape. And then I got a car to drive up to New Hampshire where my kids were and spend time with them. And it was great. Like this company, I did the interview. It was a full day interview. First time I'd ever been through a full day interview where you interviewed like everybody in the company. I went in there and learned a ton about the whole financial industry, how the whole streaming of all the prices came through, what all the identifiers were for all the stocks and things like that. And then my boss, the CTO at the time, came to me and said, hey, we realized we really need a data warehouse. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, all right. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, do you have any special technology? He's like, I don't know. Like, just go build me a data warehouse. And I'm like, what are the rules here? And he's like, try to use technology we already have, and you got a year before you have to show me anything. And I'm like, okay, like that really happened? So now I've been given a year to go and create a data warehouse, right, with no framework whatsoever. And I fall back on what we did in Monster, and the first thing I thought of was every pain point that we had in Monster in our data warehouse loads, and how do I circumvent those? And that leads me back to my coding. Object-oriented coding is super powerful. Like if you can compartmentalize things and make them reusable, everything gets easier. It's harder to initially write, right? Go slow to go fast. So what I did was I adopted the concept of every package, every table I'm loading is atomic. The destination and all the code to put the data into it is an atomic element. And now I can just build them one off. Right. But in warehousing, it's really important that, well, this table relates to this table and this table relates to this table. So I have to load this table before this table and not after this table. And like it gets really complex really fast. So at Monster, that was done with like a flow diagram in SSIS where you had each package calling the next package. And when something went wrong, you were like, where is that? Like, it was really always hard to find where it went wrong and then recreate what had happened. So what I used in the whole concept was each one of those is atomic. If I have a failure to this table, I know exactly where to go look because it's only one package that loads it. It's only one set of procs that loads it. Those procs are named the same as the package. The package is named the same as the table. All very easy to find. All of that is in source control because we talked about that earlier. That's all in Perforce in its right folder structure. So I know exactly where to go get the source control that caused that issue. how do I orchestrate what runs first? So then that was where I created my own database, and that was an orchestration database. And that kept track of what every package was, logged every package, kept track of all those things, kept track of all the high water marks of what had been loaded and what was to be loaded next, and basically built this whole database engine from the ground up.
But did you version control the orchestration database?
Of course we did. So it was really, really interesting because I from my background, which is like, I'm not going to read what somebody else did. I'm just going to go do it. And the fact that he gave me a year allowed me a lot of painful failures to figure it out. And by the time the year had passed it, I had something super functional that I was really happy with that was very easy to add new tables to. And they were really happy with it. I got headhunted by Sonos from there. They said, hey, we see that at Monster, you kind of took them from startup to enterprise, like in the scope that you were there. How would you like to do that again, knowing what you know now from a data standpoint? All right, that's compelling.
And you get to work with a cool product of all these interconnected speakers.
I didn't know that at the time. I had very little idea what Sonos was. I knew they were a speaker company. I'd looked at them before, but they were priced way outside what I was willing to pay for a speaker at the time. And I went in and did my interview with them. They agreed, like, my biggest stickling point was like, well, I work for a finance company. Like, I need to be compensated somewhere near the same. And they were like, well, we'll figure that out. Don't worry about it. And I was like, okay. So I go in and I do my interview. And again, full day interview, went through the whole deal. At the end of the interview, they hand me a coupon for 50% off of a Sonos product. And I didn't own one, but I was like, by the end of this day, I'm like, well, I got to know more about these things. This is pretty sweet. They were over in Cambridge, right by the Galleria Mall at the time. And I ordered one that day. It showed up 2 days later. I set it up and it all made sense. If you're a user of Sonos, you know how it works. If you're not, you don't know. I think it's probably one of our company's greatest marketing hurdles is how to explain what the system really does. So I thought of it as like, oh, it's like a Bluetooth speaker.
That's what everyone thinks at first.
That's what everybody thinks. And I plugged it in and I turned it on and I got it working. And I was like, oh, wait, like, hold on. Like, I can save my playlist to the speaker. Like, oh, I can put a music service on the speaker and then I can just play my music. And my phone is a remote. But if I drop my phone in the toilet, the music keeps playing, right? Like, this is great. Like, the music doesn't stop. And that was really when I really wanted the job. Like, I went through the interview process and I was kind of like, oh, this would kind of be cool. And then after I played around with the speaker, I was like, oh, I got to get in there. Like, this stuff's cool. Like, this is going to be big. They were in the situation of they had a monolithic database load for their warehouse. It was taking 17 hours to load 24 hours worth of data because they were doing an entire full load every single time. And that's only going to work for so long, right? Every night it was a little bit longer because it was always a little bit more data. So we have a deadline that cast in stone. We did upgrade the server, so we got it back down to like 14 hours. So we had a little bit more bandwidth. Rewrote Deploy-O-Matic. We had to rewrite it on a different platform. We moved away from a back-end database. We moved to using tagging and Perforce and implemented Deploy-O-Matic again. Then I started writing tools for the database engine. So you have that big metadata catalog that you have to like add the new package and then tell it what comes before and what comes after and what its sources are. So I wrote Source-O-Matic, and Source-O-Matic let you go in and you put in all those things, and it was all drop down boxes and clicks, and it would spit out the script that you then input into the metadatabase and it would do it for you. Then we had ETL config runner. This is where I deviated from my
why isn't it ETL config-o-matic?
I don't know. It must have just been a bad day. So that would literally create for you your sourcing ETL package and all the metadata that went through it in one tool, because it was very, I'm going to take the source data, I'm going to pick it up, everything that changed, and put it in this other table that's the exact same format as the source, plus these three columns that track every change. So it's basically a big audit trail. I got so tired of writing those by hand over and over. It was like, okay, yep, I know I need a tool. And we did that, and that worked really well. So again, as I found, like, that whole concept of tools to help you, writing new stuff, just trying, erroring, coming through, learning from your past mistakes. Like, if I think about how I learned from what we did at Monster when I wrote that engine, and even now that we have the engine at Sonos, we've iterated on it several times, right? now we're replatforming. Like, we're taking everything from an old platform to a modern data stack. We're going to Snowflake and dbt. And what I found really, really interesting was, as I learned dbt, I was like, hey, wait, they did my metadata engine. You just have it as a graph database behind the scenes, and I don't have to write like ETL config-o-matic. You're doing that for me just based on the code I put in. And that was like, oh, this is sweet. This is cool. That just optimized my old engine, and I didn't have to do it. Somebody else figured this out for me. That's really, really cool. So we're now moving down that path. But I still look back at my grandfather and what we did with those tools and how he brought me into that scientific method, and then using that going forward has been awesome.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So what have you learned about big data and governance here?
Big data and governance is really hard. Two things that I've learned being at Sonos. Sonos is the first company I've ever worked at where data wasn't the product. It's the first time I've been able to go to my dad and say, we make these, and like hold something in my hand and like give him one and have him understand what it is we do. From Monster, from Essential, from Patriot, from any of the other places that I've always worked, data was the product, right? Like Monster was a dating app. We were getting recruiters and job seekers together, right? That data was the product. And when I come to work at Sonos, the speaker is the product. Data has suddenly become a second-class citizen, not a first-class citizen. So we're funded. But, you know, again, I'm right back to that same world of like, well, it's easier to cut over there because they are not a, you know, they're a cost center. And no matter how many times you tell people and point them to studies that like every dollar you put into your data warehousing is $8 you'll recoup somewhere else. Like there's a million studies that say that, but everybody's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's been very different being at this company and getting people on board with doing that data and getting people to govern their data is very different. So back in the Monster days, every bit counted. We were doing things with SQL Server nobody else was doing. Brian was writing white papers for Microsoft saying like, look at the throughput we got here, right? And it was because we optimized the crap out of everything we did. Like if you couldn't tell me why you needed this field, we didn't put that field in there. Even if you thought you might use it someday, we didn't put it in. And the whole industry is pivoted to collect everything. We want everything. Get every bit of data you can possibly get. But somebody has to figure out what the value of that data is on the back end and actually want to use it. Otherwise, you just burned a whole bunch of money, right? And the argument is always like, well, but it could be valuable someday. And it's like, I bet not. And I bet that it's so old by the time you come to that realization that it's useless in its old state. And now if you turned it on now, yeah, we could probably do something interesting. So what I still fall back on for governance is you need to define the purpose of the data at the front end before it's put in and its value, not only to the transactional system where it can have value, right? That's different, but its value to the back end system to know whether it should be pulled all the way down for reporting purposes. There's plenty of data that we would use on our speakers to keep them running, that make them work together and do the magic that they do, that doesn't necessarily have a ton of value on the backend system. A lot of it does, right? So that we know the health of our systems and that we can help people with care calls and things like that. But what happens in typical development cycles everywhere is the developer leaves, a new developer comes in, doesn't know that you're collecting that old data or where it is, and they start collecting that data again in a new way. And then they leave, and another guy comes in, and that data gets collected again in some new way. And all of a sudden, you have three copies of the data that are collected in slightly different ways that don't agree with each other in the back end. And you're like, what was the value to this again?
Which one's right?
Which one's right? And what does right mean, right? you know, the whole industry has gone in this direction of collect everything and figure it all out later. And a few people, especially some other podcasts I've listened to, have found that these people who embed the report people in the same teams that are doing the data collection are hugely more efficient because they're thinking about how they're going to report on things at the front end rather than as an afterthought, right? So in business systems, that's the way it's done. But in other systems, in this whole big data world, it's whether you're actually thinking of the value at the time that you're collecting it, or are you just thinking about how do I use it for right now? And if I just need it for right now, is it worth collecting? And what value would it hold? So those companies are now finding that if they embed those data savvy people further up the stack, they're getting great efficiency and far more value from the data that they do collect because their data lake isn't just like everything and you have to go try to find a nugget. Like when the nugget lands, it's already been predefined what its value is.
So let's do a speed round on hobbies. So when I met you, you had a sick home theater system that was the envy of folks, like the big projection screen.
And still
like,
have that screen.
And the DVD changer.
Yeah.
And
that was a really interesting time for hardware, software merging. I wrote software to control the DVD changers to then have basically a computer-controlled database of all of my DVDs that I could pick from, and it would start playing it for you. But home theater was a natural fit. Television and film, going to school for that, really being passionate about it, electrical and, you know, working for my dad, and then the advent of everything being on DVD and computers and stuff. You know, so I built a home theater, stadium seating, two couches, raised the back one, 106-inch screen, Sony's first home HD projector I put in, tuned it to the point that you had to put like a red filter in front of it and then adjust all the guns properly for the different chipsets. And it was fun, right? It was a gas. Put in 7.1 surround sound, and the best, the capper was put in bass shakers in both sets of couches at the time and drove it with a separate amp. So Brian came over one time and we watched one of the many Lords of the Rings films, and one of the dragons goes to fly through the room and it flaps its wings. And I just see his head pop up and he's like looking around, it flaps its wings again. He's like, my couch shaking. Like, yep.
He's like, I spent good money on that.
Yeah. Black Hawk Down was another great film in that theater. So that was definitely a strong suit. I am still actively loving that, especially natural fit with Sonos.
Now, back in the day, you had a Supra that you had modded the heck out of. And we went for a ride one day on Route 2. And I said, how fast can this thing go? So you started opening it up. Now, the statute of limitations is long past. Now, you say we were doing 150. I swear it was closer to like 180, 190.
No. That section of Route 2, it would have taken a lot longer to get there. We basically capped before the first exit, if I recall correctly, from where we got on. But that car was modded, but it was basically what they call BPU, which is basic performance upgrade. So we hadn't changed out the turbos or anything like that. We'd basically just gotten rid of the boost control that capped it at anything. As I recall that day, I recall you were riding your Indian that day, and I made you put the Indian in the Supra's parking spot because I had gotten a good parking spot when we took off to go for a ride. We sat at the bottom of the entrance ramp and let as many people go by as could. And there was a light, I think, just prior to the entrance ramp we were on Route 2. And so we just let all of the traffic from the light go. And waited and waited and waited and waited and waited until finally the truck that was behind us beeped its horn and kind of went sideways onto the highway and rode up through at least 4th into 5th. And as I recall, it was about 155 that we capped at. May have been closer to 160, but it was around 155. I just remember as we came back to the office, I came back and we went to work and I thought, huh. And I swung by your desk and I was like, hey, Andrew, what's the fastest you've ever been? And you're like about 10 minutes ago, I apparently went about 160 miles an hour.
So you have an EV now, like, is there the same sort of hacking with the performance?
I wish that that existed. This is a call out to anybody out there who can figure out ways to build capacitors in for quick bursts of speed to do things with the performance in EVs. That would be awesome. But I have not seen that. I may have mellowed slightly with age. Pretty much gone pure EV at our home with a Chevy Bolt, which is a well, I like to think of it as a sleeper kid carrier and a brilliant commuter car. And then we also have the extended range Model 3 that is a rocket ship in its own right.
With my EV, I get the random like Ram 2500 owner that wants to roll coal on me for,
totally.
For some reason. I'm totally. Like, dude, I like trucks too. Like, why do you hate EVs so much?
Right. Like, there's room for both of us. Yeah, no, I've had that same experience as well. I have loved EVs. This is probably, again, part of the whole technology thing. But anything that has to do with EVs, not going to a gas station, coming out every morning. I will say the number one thing about an EV that I didn't think of before I bought it was there's no maintenance.
There's one fluid.
Yeah.
The windshield washer.
Yeah. Yep. In my Bolt, I've had the thing, I got 80,000 miles on it now. I've put 2 cabin air filters in it, changed the tires, and just recently the rear wiper motor went. I haven't done brakes. I haven't done anything to that thing.
As regen then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all regen. I drive it in what they call low, which is 1 foot mode, which is the way the Tesla pretty much normally operates. And like, there's no brake dust on my wheels. Like, I used to have to clean my wheels like daily in the Supra or in like the Subaru that I had for a while. Like, they just ate up brake. But with the regenerative stuff, like, the only time you use the brakes is when you really, really need them. So I love that fact. And when you tell people that, they're like, oh, no oil changes, no transmission changes, no nothing.
It's not just the cost, it's the annoyance of every 5 to 10,000 miles. Like, go make an appointment at Speedy or, God forbid, the dealership.
Yep. Or once or twice a week, pull into that big area with all those stinky pumps and have to deal with all those people. Like, I get up every morning, I come out, and my car is ready to go 200 miles. People are like, do you have range anxiety? It's like, rarely go more than 200 miles in a day. And if I do, I'm usually going someplace where there's a charger at the end that I can plug into. And in the Tesla, it doesn't matter. I can go anywhere because there's a million chargers everywhere and it knows exactly where everyone is. So I still think about going back to an ICE vehicle for fun. I do miss shifting. I have to say that a clutch and a stick shift is kind of in my soul, but is kind of gone. I'm waiting for them to come out with a stick shift electric car. I don't know if you've heard of a company called Ariel. They made a car called the Atom, which was basically a track car that you could drive on the street. Had no roof, had no cabin. It basically had a teeny tiny windscreen, sat two. It looked like those three-wheel kind
like
of
motorcycle-y things,
but it was 4 wheels and it was just super light, all exposed tubular frame. And they sold pretty well, but they're really just for track, right? And they're like $40,000 for a track car, right? But you can drive it on the street. It has directionals and stuff, rides like a tank, but you know, whatever. I've always been intrigued by those. I thought that's cool that somebody's taken like a pure track car, not a supercar, but something accessible and then turned it into, you know, something that you could buy, drive on the street, drive to the track, race for fun, and then drive home. They've now come out with an Atom EV, or it may just be called the Ariel EV, 1150 horsepower. EV car with a turbine for regenerative electricity. So no motor, a turbine on the back that looks like it's propelling your car. Basically looks like a small Batmobile.
I was going to say, it sounds like the Batmobile.
It's awesome. They just announced it. There's no pricing on it yet or anything like that. But that thing is intriguing as hell. And you can get it in 2-wheel or 4-wheel. And like, I'm like, that would be ridiculous. And the secondary one is there was a new EV car that just ran some classic hill race in the UK that actually has a giant fan in the bottom that actually sucks it to the ground. So it has, again, like some 1,200 horsepower or something. Some of that horsepower is used to drive the fan.
Active downforce.
So you can take a corner at like 2 G's without a problem.
Just sucks the ground like a suction cup.
Suction cup and drives you through the corner.
That's pretty cool. Well, you're going to have to come up with some links for our show notes for these.
Totally.
What about beekeeping?
Beekeeping, yeah, I just took that up this year. That was an interesting one. We had a swarm of bees land in a bush in our yard, and I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And I read up on it real quick and bought a hive from Amazon. It showed up the next day, dumped them in the hive, and thought I would give that a shot. They left 2 days later. So again, but you know, you learn from your mistakes, right?
And you got to try it.
You got to try it.
And you got to iterate.
And now I have a beehive. What the hell am I going to do if I don't put bees in it, right? So then I bought bees from a guy up in Concord and went up and picked them up. talk about an interesting experience. He's like, oh, I can give you a knock, which is like a small hive that you can take back with you and empty it into your hive. Or you can just bring me your hive and we can just load it up. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like looking at my hive and there's no way to like make it so the bees can't get out because that's like the whole point. So like I put some like screening that I had from an old screen door and I put that over the entrance and, you know, kind of taped it in place. And we went up to Concord and took that out of the car. And like this guy's been doing this for years. He doesn't have like he has a veil, but he's like in a short sleeve shirt playing around with all the bees. He's like, these are very docile bees. Don't worry about it. So I'm like standing like 6 feet away. Okay, all right, whatever. And he's taking out the different pieces. He's taking out the frames and he's putting them in my hive and he's taking the empty frames out of my hive and putting it back in his. So now I have like 3,000 bees in my hive. He's like, okay, go ahead, take it home. And I'm like, okay. And I got my wife with me. She's in the front seat and I open up the back of the bolt, put it in there and I close it down. And I'm like, all right, it's about a 20-minute drive home. So we're driving home and like you can just hear from the back seat, like of all these bees inside this hive.
Did they get out?
Well, we got towards home and all of a sudden I'm like, hey, that's a bee on the rear window. I'm like, uh-oh, I might have to drive faster. And then it was like, hey, there's a second bee. And we were getting closer to home. And by the time we got home, there were about four bees and they were all just staying in the back. It's a hatchback. Could have very easily come up and said hello, but stayed in their space. And we get home and like my wife jumps out of the car and runs in. I get out of the car and I run in and grab my bee suit, come out and open up the back of the car, pick up this hive. And it's like, and like, I look and I see the mesh is like folded in on one end. And I'm like, oh God. And I took it to where it needed to be and put it down and like went back and made sure all the bees had flown out of the car. And it went well. It went well. I lost my queen again. So the beehive is now full of all the bees, but there's no queen to continually lay. And I'm not sure there ever was a queen. I don't know if she escaped. I don't know if she never, like, she could have flown off immediately when she got put in. So I found nearby there was another beekeeper who was selling queens. And I went and got a new queen and put that in. And everything's been great. When I got that one, they put a green dot in paint on the back of the queen so you can easily identify her. So when you go out and you inspect your hives, you can be like, oh, still got my queen. It's right there. Instead of just having to gauge by their size and their shape, which if I was any good at it, I'd be able to do by now.
So, Ben, thank you very much for making the long trek down and joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew. It was a pleasure to rehash some great memories.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.